And right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us, of course, on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast David on the weekend, also during our noontime hour during the week. He is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He's got his own website, themediabeat.us. And once again, he joins us this morning. Good morning, David.
Well, good morning. Good to join you from the media capital of the world, New York City. How are you?
Bedazzled.
Bedazzled by what?
By yesterday, trying to get away from just horrible news. Another shooting, of course, this time at a school in California, and then enveloped around that, of course, the. It was an off day for the impeachment proceedings, but a lot of stuff going on there.
Lots of time for comment.
And
media filled with comment and interpretation of the one day so far of the impeachment proceedings, the investigation part of impeachment, at least. And we're, of course, we're on again today. We speak Friday morning, and in a couple of hours, there'll be another hearing. It's very attention getting if you're prepared to allow your attention to be got. There's certainly enough people and exercised enough. And well, here it goes again.
That's great. And you know what's interesting, David? When I look at the news, there's so many other stories to cover that seem to get squeezed out by this. Like what is going on in Hong Kong is really close to the breaking point. What's going on there, and that has very very little coverage here right now.
Well, yeah, it's not finite. I mean, the media scene is infinitely expandable. On the other hand, we need focuses. We need a sense of what's containable in our attention span and our attention, the extent of our attention, the breadth of it. And of course, we traditionally, at least, we've relied on media curators, I think they're called these days. We used to call them editors, I suppose. People who actually make the choices for us to make the task of understanding the world a little bit better. But now it's something of a mess, and we begin, and I think we have very good reason to doubt the wisdom of the curators, the people who decide the menu. Yes, all sorts of things are being pushed to the margins, like China. Even in a way that's surprising, because you'd think that the same people who want to put the impeachment process so much to the fore would also want to keep us abreast with Trump's other legal problems, like, for instance, his efforts, desperate efforts, it seems, to keep the legal machinery of this land away from his private accounts. He's appealing all the way to the Supreme Court to prevent the public having any sight of those accounts. And that's a story that it's there to be found, but boy, you do have to look for it. It's being pushed to the margins by this very substantial, if it is substantial, process of the impeachment investigation. The Republicans have taken an interesting tactic now. It does seem to be, there's been a lot of very, very different approaches on the Republican side, you know, lurching really from attempts to respond to the developing charges in particular, to just being attack dogs on the president's behalf and trying desperately to disparage the witnesses that come before the committee, the House committee. But it seems to be resolving into one unified strategy now, which is not an unwise one. It's probably quite a smart one to adopt, which is just attempt to tarnish the whole process as a waste of time. And you can see that having a certain resonance with a lot of people, because after all, we do know that it's highly unlikely that even if impeachment articles are prepared in the House by the committee that's in charge of it, the Intelligence Committee, interestingly, not the Judicial Committee, which gives rise to a whole lot of other questions. But even if these articles are prepared, everybody knows that it's going to go nowhere after that. The Senate will not vote to displace this president. And so that, given that as a background and as a sort of fairly well understood fact of political fact of life, you can see why tarnishing the whole thing as a waste of the public's time and the public's money, of course, you can see why that could gain a big push amongst Republicans.
You know, it's interesting to sit here and you look at these stories and then you draw back and sit back for a while and you take a look at the world in general, the worldview in general. And the United States is completely, really isolated from some incredible things happening. I mean, you have rockets being lobbed into Israel, Israel responding there. But also Israel, for the first time that I can, they didn't go after Hamas. They went after the actual other people that shot that shot.
Is the Islamic Jihad presence inside but Gaza, yes.
Look what's going on in Lebanon with the government there. There's so many things that the United States used to be involved in and looked upon to be part of as a solution, and we're completely left out now. I mean, we really are becoming an island.
And further, it leads to exactly what I suppose America's interventionist, if you want to call it that, approach to being the leader of the free world, the other label that we apparently appeared so proud of at one stage, is that if you see your role as interventionist in some grand way on behalf of better things for the world at large, then if you then turn inwardly, as this administration has done in its nativist and isolationist way, then you lose influence. The case of Syria at the moment is a huge example of that. America decided, or Trump decided on behalf of America, to step back and allow Turkey to invade northern Syria. And now who's basically in charge of that patch of the world? It's Russia. And that should come as no surprise to anybody. But is that what was envisaged in the first place? I doubt it. Or perhaps people who take that nativist, isolationist view really do believe that it doesn't matter in the end.
It's just you look back and it's, President Trump has been president for what, two and three quarters of a year, and there's just we have withdrawn from treaties that affect the environment. We have withdrawn from treaties that affect the building of nuclear weapons. We have strategically made blunders in what we're doing in the Middle East. Now, it's not like, don't get me wrong, it's not like the administrations before this one haven't had their blunders in foreign policy. That's one.
Other administrations before have said very loudly and insistently that we don't want to be the world's policeman. Also, but there are limits to abandoning all responsibility.
That's what I was going to say. It's one thing about okay, we're not going to go for regime change anymore. We're going to do more diplomatic. I mean, that's one thing. But to totally withdraw and then to withdraw from accords like the environment and everything. I mean, it is a total withdrawal from being involved in the world communications, and it takes our allies to a new level of wow. Can we count on the United States?
Sure, absolutely. look at the European media at the moment, and it's as if America has just not exactly disappeared off the map, but it's not a consideration what America might or might not think or want to do in any particular arena of world events. It's a different universe.
Well, it's here, and it's what we all have to deal with for the next several years, obviously. But then you know, finally this morning, I was scanning. I listen to AM radio, folks. Yes, I do. I'm sorry. I was scanning the dial coming in this morning. And finally, somebody uttered something that I've been saying for weeks now. And it all came about with Mr. Bloomberg and Governor Patrick, former governor of Massachusetts, where finally a commentator, and I don't even know who it was because I'm not sure what station it was on the AM dial, basically said...
An AM radio commentator.
Yeah.
Yes. Now you must quote. That's the fanfare. Now what were his words?
The words were that it's so apparent now. Look at... Bloomberg came out and had his announcement, right? Has done nothing since then. So obviously it's Bloomberg's announcement that his registering Alabama was just like a shot across the bow to see if he could stir up some excitement. That didn't stir up much excitement. And strange enough, a week after that, Deval Patrick now is going to enter the race. If people don't think that the Democratic National Committee is not behind this, they're just crazy, because I've been saying for months now the Democratic National Committee has got a big problem. And they're called Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and they have about 40 to 42% of every. When it doesn't matter what poll, and I don't believe in polling right now to see who's going to win, but they're so strong, they're stronger together than the other candidates are together, and that has the Democratic National Committee working on a way to get to the second vote at the Democratic National Convention, where superdelegates count. You can just see that what is going on here, because it's no political party in the world. When you finally narrowed it down to 10 people on stage, it wants to add another two. It's so obvious what's going on here with the Democratic Party, and they're about to shoot themselves in the foot again.
Yeah, and become an institution of managers, of manipulators, which has been the suspicion about the grandees of the Democratic Party many times around. And I fear you're right, that we may well see that happening again in a final annual, I mean not annual, but you know, four yearly convention that brings out what many people think of as the worst in party managers, and you get something that is very far from the wishes of the people themselves getting enacted in convention decisions.
It's you know, I'm 67, and it's just, I've really been actively involved following the news since I was 14 in my house. My father made us read newspapers, made us watch the evening news, had us be involved with things like this. We used to have discussions around, yes, at one time, folks, families ate dinner around a table in the evenings.
and they talked to each other,
that,
I guess.
That's
huh?
exactly right. And so I've been acutely aware of what's been going on. I in my life have not seen the United States in a position like this in the world view since I can remember being interested in watching what's going on. It's just a very, I'm not saying it's a bad place, because you don't know if it's bad, whether it's good for the world or bad for the world, but it's just such a different place right now, the way America is internally and the way it's viewed from the outside.
Yeah, one of the most rhetorical questions asked during the proceedings of the one day so far that we've had of the impeachment public hearings was one addressed to Ambassador Bill Taylor, the top man in it now since June, in the embassy in Ukraine, the U.S. embassy in Ukraine. And the question was, have you ever in your long experience as a diplomat seen anything like this? And of course, he just had to say, "No, sir." Yeah. And that's repeated all across the board at the moment. We're dealing. It's the most overused phrase in politics right now. We're dealing in uncharted waters. And it's the same in Britain, as you make the comparison every week, and I think you're right, very similar developments are taking in Britain around ostensibly different issues, but underneath it all, it probably is much of the same thing. But what is definitely shared between them, the two countries, leaders of the Western world, in turn, as they have been over the century, the last couple of centuries, is that we've not been here before, ever, in our history, as far as we can tell.
You know, I sit here and I say to myself, there's only one way this is all going to change, I know, in the United States, and that is the younger generation who is now eligible to vote for the first time, and those who were eligible to vote last time, have to stop electing people that legislate from the past. You know, even if I don't agree with them, you should start voting for your future, because their future is now. That's the thing that has not been pushed, really, is that, and I think people are overlooking. I do believe that a lot of younger people are going to vote in this election. I do believe that they're tired of the same politicians, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, being politicians from the past. They want to look into the future. And that's where I think all these polls are so, so far off.
They are indicating, and on the Democratic side at least, they're indicating huge amount of support for, underappreciatedly big amount of support for, as you were saying earlier, senators Warren and Sanders, and yet look at the age of those two candidates. It's an extraordinary sense of we're still living in the past, or at least we're not blowing in a breath of fresh young air, are we?
It's going to be very interesting to watch and see how this finally develops. What is it? 3 months to Iowa?
That's right.
We can finally put all this to start to put it to bed. And anyway,
it'll be interesting as a media watcher for me to see how much attention is paid to the broader issues that you've just been alluding to, this sort of generational change. The only candidate who's drawing overt attention to the need for that kind of change is Andrew Yang, of course. He's talking about how our entire society is undergoing extraordinary challenges, which will lead to, very hard to adjust to changes in our whole social fabric. And he's talking mainly about the economic and social impact of the technological age, changing just about everything that we know about the way we work and the way we live. But that's not really been tackled with any great seriousness. Anyone can see why not, because you've got an autocrat in the White House, and issues of governance seem to matter much more, and indeed equality and inequality have rushed to the fore, certainly for this electorate, the people who get polled about supporting which Democrat. Of course, that's a segmentized piece of polling that goes on. But the fact that eventually we're going to have to consider all those important issues that Andrew Yang is bringing up, are we going to do it in this round of electioneering? And if we don't do it, then when are we going to do it? That's the sort of question that I would have thought that the younger generation will be taking the fore in arguing and maybe getting some change out of it as well. We'll have to wait and see.
All right, and then there's just the last few moments here. I wonder what's going to happen next week when they actually bring in the person to testify that gives first person's reference to what the president said on the telephone.
You see, to me, somebody actually there for the phone call itself.
Yeah, somebody who was actually
on
the line.
I heard him say this.
Yeah.
In fact, she apparently is capable of recalling the words of the president at the other end of the line. He must have been shouting.
it's an amazing thing to look at. But finally, the Democrats are calling it what it should be called, which is, if he used money that was approved by the House and the Senate to be spent on the Ukraine for military purposes, for their security. And the President of the United States took that money and held it up because he has a personal grudge against the Bidens. That is the ultimate form of corruption. There's no doubt about it. You know, it's just not legal, and it's going to be very interesting to see if this all washes out like that.
The choice of words available to the Democrats has been interesting. People have gotten hung up a little bit on quid pro quo. Yeah. It's never particularly catchy.
It's bribery.
Communications. I'm stuck on that word myself a bit. It's hard to work through. It's not hard. You still have to work through the process to see that what he's accused of doing is actual bribery. The word extortion comes to my mind.
That is a better
more
word.
Appropriate.
No,
unfortunately, extortion isn't there in the list of impeachable crime, high crimes and misdemeanors that the founders put together. Not a very long list, of course, but I think it's a presentational problem that the Democrats have. They can't quite put a really firm defining word on what it is the president is alleged to have done.
You're right, because I haven't heard one person say that this quid pro quo, or whatever you want to call it, is the president of the United States taking public money that was dedicated for something and holding it back for personal gain.
Unless someone does something for him.
Yeah,
yes.
For personal gain.
That's extortion. It's almost the opposite of bribery. It's saying, I won't give you the money if you don't do this. But if you do this, then I'll give you the money. Well, sure, that's bribery.
Yeah.
But, the awful suspicion that I guess that a lot of people have when they see bribery in that list of potentially high crimes and misdemeanors, when the founding fathers were talking about impeachment, is that when it mentions bribery there, the suspicion is that they mean that the president has been bribed. It's the other way around in this case. He's the one who's doing the extorting, or allegedly so, anyway. So the label is crucial in presentational terms and just in terms of what you call things, which is so fundamental to the Democrats winning the battle for public opinion here, because the public is not so clearly moved by this whole impeachment idea. I mean, as we were saying right at the beginning, there's an inbuilt sense that this might be a whole waste of, a big waste of time. So getting something, it boils down to this communicator skill, boiling it down to some snappy phrase that people will instantly get and understand as the charge against Trump. That's the problem, and we still haven't got there yet.
I think once next week when we get that firsthand testimony, we'll get there fairly quickly. And then that's not going to make any difference in the Senate because, as was proved with Bill Clinton, even though in his impeachment a lot of Democrats did cross over, but not enough to get him convicted in the Senate. It's going to be interesting if any Republicans at all vote to convict in the Senate at all. And I seriously doubt it. We're just such a politicized
nation. At the moment, it's looking like a handful at most, right?
Yeah. I don't even think it's a handful. I mean, I would say maybe two.
A couple.
That's it. Bingo. I was going to say two digits on your hand is what I would think it is right now. Well, it's interesting to see because it definitely is a world in turmoil. It's a different sort of turmoil than I lived through as a kid, the nuclear crisis where the bomb might drop at any time with the Cold War. That was a crisis unto itself, and what the world is going through now is just as, to me, in my opinion, a similar crisis. It just doesn't involve a nuclear bomb yet.
Yeah, and in some ways the whole flavor of it is different too. I mean, I may just be a crotchety old curmudgeon to say this, but to me, it just feels grimy and tacky. It doesn't have that horrendous, momentous quality to it, mainly because the people involved are such small people, including, you know, in my opinion at least, the man at the center of it all. Petty.
David, thank you very much. We will speak to you next week.
I look forward to that.
Take care.
See you then.
David Terechuk with us this morning once again with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio.